The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand. Join the Hyundai revolution.
President Jimmy Carter has written more than two dozen books over the course of his career about everything from the art of aging to how to achieve peace in the Middle East. His writings are anchored by a deep-seated belief that all people should be granted the same set of rights and freedoms. He's just published another book called A Call to Action: Women, Religion, Violence and Power. President Carter, very nice to talk to you. And may I ask you, what motivated you to write this particular book?
Well, the Carter Center, where my wife and I have worked since I left the White House, has had programs in 80 different countries in the world. And for the last 3 years, we've been concentrating on the subject of the abuse of women and girls, which is the worst single uncorrected problem that the world faces. And we ignore it, basically. And this horrendous example of violation of human rights continues almost unabated. Not only in you know, the poor world of Africa and so forth, but also in Europe and in the United States.
On reading your book, one can see that you have a profound faith yourself. And yet you say that for political or religious reasons, more females have been murdered worldwide than all of the people who have died in every war during that same span of time.
That's certainly correct. There are almost 10 million little babies that are killed every year by their parents in countries where the government either mandates that they can only have one or two children, or because the families are so poor they can't support their families and can't feed more children. And since they want a boy to kind of help support them when they get into their old age, they murder their daughters, sometimes with the understanding or even approval of the governments. And this has been exacerbated in recent years since sonograms became available in the very poor communities, because now they can detect the sex of a developing fetus and they abort the fetus if it's going to be female. So this is what goes on, and it goes on almost unabated. And it's just one of those things, and perhaps the worst thing of all, that is being perpetrated against girls and women.
You make the point that people of faith tend to argue from within their own faith to justify shibboleths, I suppose is the correct word, about equality. And you are particularly critical of your own Christian church, as well as the Catholic Church, and less so, I suppose, because of the distance with Muslims. But you go and Jewish people. But you go back to your own childhood and you talk about slaves, and that your best friends were black boys that you were on the farm with, and that even though people felt a discomfort about slavery, it suited them. So they ignored the concept of equality because they had something to gain.
That's exactly right. And there's a quite close parallel between the way we treated black people in the southern part of the United States, in fact, all over our country. For 100 years after the Civil War, when slavery was actually legally abolished, but we discriminated against blacks as separate but equal. They were separate, but they certainly were not equal. They couldn't vote, and they couldn't serve on juries, and they had inferior schools, inferior health care, inferior jobs. And we really kind of, even though the ones who deplored this practice, we benefited from it because we got the best jobs, we got the best education, the white people did. And we would have very distinguished religious leaders come into our little church, where my father was a deacon and also a pastor, I mean also a Sunday school teacher, and they would say that God ordained that whites be superior to blacks. And we have the same thing now in some of the religious organizations where top authorities within the religious organizations say that women are inferior to men. They're not qualified to be a priest. They're not qualified to be a deacon in the Southern Baptist Convention, and in 2000 we changed our policy. I was a Southern Baptist before that, by saying that women also couldn't be chaplains, and they couldn't even teach a classroom in the higher education institutions if there was a boy in the class. So these kind of things give a signal to the secular world that if women are inferior in the eyes of God, then why should we pay them an equal pay to men who work in our shop, or why should we refrain from abusing our wife if we are a strong husband and our wife displeases us? So this contributes to the problem. And I'm not, by the way, I'm going to say quickly that I'm not critical of other religions because, you know, I have my own belief. I teach Sunday school every Sunday in my church. And when I have a problem with the 36,000 or so verses in the Bible that can be interpreted in different ways, I go back to the actions and words and teachings of Jesus Christ, who was one of the foremost champions of women's rights, and went out of his way to make sure that women were never treated in an inferior way.
But we are repeatedly told that he didn't, that among the 12 there was no woman.
Well, that was the culture of the time. If a woman had been a deacon, I mean, had been a disciple, then the other people would not have listened to her because they hadn't absorbed what Jesus taught. But we also know that the 12 disciples were cowering in fear and trepidation inside a closed room when Jesus was crucified, and his women followers, who were very loyal to him all the way through, were right there with him at the crucifixion, and they never abandoned Christ. In fact, they were there on the first Easter morning as well, as you well know. And while the men were hiding.
Yes, but I mean, one could still argue, because I mean, within the Roman Catholic Church, there's there is debate, but the second last pope actually disbarred debate on the question of women's ordination.
Well, you know, I'm not criticizing the Catholic Church, but I go back to what Jesus did and what St. Paul wrote. Paul wrote that all are equal in the eyes of God, men and women, slaves and masters, Jews and Gentiles. And then in his 16th chapter of Romans, with which I'm sure you are familiar, he lists about 25 of the early leaders in the church at all levels of authority, and about half of them, roughly, are women. So these, you can argue either way you want to, back and forth. I wrote to Pope Francis, whom I really respect and admire. I wrote him a letter about some of the facts in my book and so forth, and asked him to join with me in trying to alleviate the suffering of women and girls, the persecution of them. I didn't ask him to change the policy of the Catholic Church. He wrote me a very nice letter back, and he said that in his opinion, the status of women, even within the Catholic Church, should be enhanced or improved in the future.
You also raised that issue with Pope John Paul II.
Yes.
In the White House.
I did.
You got a slightly different response?
Well, he was much more conservative. I raised the issue of contraception, and I raised the issue of women's equality with him in a very long and very friendly and private conversation. I found him to be quite reluctant to discuss those two issues, so I didn't pursue them. We talked about other things. But I think that I have read the statements that that Pope Francis has made, and I also saw that just a few days ago he appointed a committee to look into the abuse of children by priests, and half the committee members are women. One of them was a woman who had been abused, I understand, when she was in a convent as a child. So I think there's some stirrings within the church. I'm not saying that the church is going to make women be priests. I think that's too much to expect. But I think that there can be a reaching out to women to make sure that the church takes a strong position in condemning any abuse of women or treating them as inferior human beings in the eyes of God.
There are two other areas that I'd really like to cover. One is rape trials in the United States and rape within the military, and rape within universities? Because I found your book very shocking on that.
Well, the two of the most revered institutions in America are the two you just mentioned, the university system of our country and also our military. I'm, as you know, I'm a professor on have been for 32 years at Emory University, and I know what goes on the campus, and I even give an example of a young girl that was staying in our house who was raped on a college campus when I was governor of Georgia. But only 4%, one out of 25, of sexual abuse cases on college campuses are ever reported to the authorities.
Why not?
Because the leaders of the universities, the presidents, the chancellors, the deans, do not want it to be known that these kind of crimes are taking place under their leadership on their college campus. So they get the girl when they find that she has been raped and maybe physically abused and has bruises all over her sexual organs and so forth. They counsel the girl and say, well, you know, let's don't prosecute the boy. Let's don't make a big issue out of it. We'll counsel with the boy. We'll make sure he doesn't do it again. And by the way, you don't want to be brought on to a jury trial and have to get up and testify about what kind of clothes you were wearing and how many boys you had dated and whether you put your tongue in their mouth when you kissed them and things of that kind. And so they discourage the girls from making these reports, and they don't do it. And so this is one of the most serious, unaddressed, and ignored crimes, even concealed crimes, in the United States. About one out of four or one out of five girls who matriculate in a university in the United States are sexually abused while they're in college. In the military, the Defense Department was forced to make a report the year before last in 2012. There were 26,000 or more sexual abuse cases that were reported, and only about 300 of them ever resulted in any punishment for the rapist. That's not much more than 1%. And the reporting in civilian life in our country is extremely higher, six to ten times as high in civilian life as it is in our university systems or in the military.
And why in the military?
These are the problems.
Why in the military would there not be proper procedures when that would happen?
My profession was in the military. I was a submarine officer. And I know that the last thing that a commanding officer of a ship or battalion or a company wants is to have reported under his leadership that his people for whom he's responsible is committing illegal acts of a sexual nature. So we have in our country a law which the U.S. Senate attempted unsuccessfully last week to change that gives the commanding officer exclusive control over whether or not a sexual assault case is brought against the man the man who attacks a woman. And so the legal part of the military don't have the authority. No one has the authority except the commanding officer that is in charge of the man who committed the crime and the woman who's a victim. And the commanding officers just don't want to have it reported on their record that under their leadership, these kinds of crimes took place.
Right. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about a play that's going to start in Washington this week and also about what happens to your emails. But you also write very passionately about how women are mutilated and in how many countries and in what percentages.
Well, let's just take Egypt, for instance, which is in the news. Over 90% of all the females in Egypt of all ages have been sexually mutilated. And in some countries, the percentage is above 95% of all females in a country have had their sexual organs cut when they were little girls. And this is done not because it's in the Quran, it's never mentioned. It's not because religious leaders or even husbands want it done. It's because women were mutilated when they were little girls, and they think that's a cultural pressure on them to do the same thing to their little girls when they are born.
Right.
And so we are trying now, without interfering in the local cultural system, to convince the women that they and their little girls have basic human rights, and that this is not required by any authority or any religion, and for them to correct the problem themselves. So some good progress is being made in several countries now in Africa.
Now, I mean, you also talk about honor killings, you talk about slavery and prostitution, but I want to come back a little bit to yourself. You're going to turn 90 this year. You don't really seem to have hung up your boots yet, do you?
No, not yet. I haven't done it yet. But you mentioned honor killings. In 2010, which is the last figures that have been issued, there were more than 2,800 honor killings in the United Kingdom in Great Britain in 2010.
Right.
So it's not just in one part. No, I haven't hung up my boots yet.
Now, I saw you quoted as saying that you believe that the NSA is monitoring your emails.
Well, I know they're recording my emails and my telephone calls, because they record everyone in the United States. So every time a phone call is made, it's automatically recorded and kept by the NSA. And then they have a very rubber stamp type court now. And if the NSA wants to look at any of those telephone calls or emails, then they are perfectly at liberty to do so. I think the NSA has exceeded even the very liberal laws that were passed by the intelligence committees without the knowledge of other members of the Congress that don't have top secret clearance. And I think they've gone far beyond what they should have done. And I think the revelations of what they are doing, which I think is basically accurate, will result in some corrective action.
Right. Well, I gather that when you're writing to world leaders that you send a letter through the post office, considering it more secure. One of the great achievements of your presidency was the Middle East.
Yes.
And tell me about the play that's opening in Washington this
week. Oh, I saw it last night.
You saw it. Tell me about it.
For the first time, yes. It is absolutely superb. There are four actors. One plays me and Begin and Sadat and my wife. Those are the four actors. And it's just an emotional play. At the end of the 90-minute performance, there's no intermission. The audience stood up and applauded almost interminably. And I bet you that half of the audience had tears running down their cheeks. What? It was really an emotional thing, not because of what I did, but because of the interrelationship between the three of us as presented in this dramatic presentation.
Over the 13 days. It has to be said, you know, you've had more success there than any other president, as far as I can see. And yet, you're shunned on it now because of a book you wrote about apartheid and the Palestinians.
Yes, by some American public officials, I'm kind of shunned, but because it's not politically acceptable in many circles of my country to want to have an equal hand between the Palestinians and the Israelis, because the Israeli promoters or supporters or lobbyists in America are so powerful.
Right. Does it bother you? I saw Obama is the only president since your presidency that doesn't ring you for advice.
Well, I think that's mainly because I've been out of office so long. You know, it's natural for a president to call and consult with the people who have just succeeded him recently. So I'm not angry or peeved or anything. I'm not lonely. I get enough telephone calls without one from the White House. So I get along just
fine.
Listened
to or not. Over.
Yes, it's true. Oh, yes, it's true. I didn't mean to contradict what you said.
Okay, listen.
I've enjoyed it.
It's very nice to talk to you. I wish you well. I'm glad that the play went so well, and I wish you well with the book. And I hope that a lot of people read it and take on board what you say about human rights.
It's already a bestseller, just the quickest I've ever had. Well, thank you very much.
Okay,
bye-bye.
President Carter, thank
Goodbye.
You very much indeed.
1850 715 150.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Everyone's talking about the revolution driven by Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, before talking any more about President Carter, there have been a lot of phone calls and texts and emails about the whole discussion on the GAA. And it has to be said, the bulk of them ringing in anyway, were negative, and people are feeling a bit sore about it all. But one in particular apparently really annoyed people, and I'm very sorry because those particular guests aren't here now. They have left the studio. But one in particular said, Fiona Looney, you just completely dissed the real victim of this story, i.e. the old farmer down the road who can listen on the radio or go to the pub. There are many of these old farmers around the country who have been the true supporters over the years, and not just fair weather supporters. They deserve to see the game that they supported for years on their own TVs. And I'm just reading that out because it represents quite a lot of calls that came in on that. So I presume the discussion will go on and on. Well, I just still with me in studio to talk about President Carter is Declan Power. We were just talking. He had a very successful presidency. It was one term. But everybody kind of thinks that he developed after he was president. Was Iran done for him, wasn't it?
I'm sorry? There was?
Iran.
Yes, it was. And you've just hit the nail on the head. I think because of the nature of the circumstances of him finishing in office, that became emblematic.
Remind people what happened.
Well, as you were reminding me earlier indeed about it, the successes of his presidency. Oh. And we heard about how he brought two implacable foes to a table that had never been done before. But against the backdrop of that, you had the revolution in Iran. You had this fundamentalist Islamic Republic under the Ayatollah Khomeini come into power, and amongst other things, the relationship with the United States was broken off, and they took control of the embassy and held on to a number of employees, US nationals. And as a result, the US was not meeting any success to try and negotiate the release. So a special operation was conceived to send in special forces to get them out. Now, the problem with these kinds of things, and I'm often minded to think about it in more modern times, people think special forces are omnipotent and they're supermen. But you know, it's one thing to get into effect an operation in an embassy, but you have to get to the location. And it was the getting of the location that was the disaster. You had a number of different organisations involved to fly the special forces into a part of the desert, and then they were going to get from there to the actual location. And in the doing of that, there was a collision, and a number of servicemen were killed, and then the operation saw the light of day. It was an embarrassment for the US, and it undermined support for Jimmy Carter politically, and throughout the country there was a lack of confidence in him. But as you quite rightly point out, after his presidential career, he moved on to become a very skillful, erudite, sensitive envoy.
Yeah.
And an awful lot of what he has been involved in and has done hasn't fully seen the light of day yet.
No, I mean, he won a Nobel Peace Prize. But he, Panama Canal treaties, the Camp David Accords, Egypt and Israel, SALT II treaty with the Soviet Union, establishment of diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China. And one of the things, I just can't find the reference to right now, he was commander-in-chief and there wasn't a gun fired in anger militarily while he was in charge.
The US did not get drawn into any major conflicts, that you know, the major conflict mills, if you like.
Yeah.
I mean, it's ironic in a sense. His career, political career, got ended because of a particular incident that led to a loss of life. Nothing along the lines of the loss of life that has happened with regards to Iraq, Afghanistan or Vietnam. Like, if you want to take just a couple of different conflicts, he can't be associated or blamed for any of them. But one particular operation, and it torpedoed his career.
It destroyed his career. It's kind of really tragic. But, and he lived such an active life. He certainly, I don't mean to offend any 90-year-old that's listening, but he sounds as fresh
He does.
And a man of great conviction.
And it comes across, doesn't it? Anytime I've ever heard him speak, I think it helps with the southern accent. But he comes across as a fairly defined and steadfast, but not aggressive, and that he's going to attain his objectives and he's going to keep going. And I'm reminded of a story I once heard he mentioned in his previous career about being in the US Navy. And to get his place in the US Naval Academy, he needed to pass a medical, and he had flat feet or pronated arches or whatever the term du jour is. And he was worried about this, did a bit of research, and was told by somebody, whether it helped or not, that if he walked for so many hours a day around the house in his bare feet on crushed Coke cans, now actually with the cans attached to his feet, that it would help stimulate the muscles in his arch. And he did this for hours every day before he got to school, but after he went to school, in order to meet the medical requirements to get into the US Naval Academy. And I think that's Jimmy Carter. He'll walk on whatever it takes to get to wherever he needs to get.
The determination. It's true. And listen, thank you very, very much indeed for that. And we'll take a break.
1850 715 150.
And that's it from us for today. I would like to thank all of those who contributed. Peter McKenna, Fiona Looney, Mary Hannafin, Declan Power, Mick O'Keefe, Mark Duncan, John Bowman, and indeed Jimmy Carter for their contribution to the programme today. As I say, that's all we have time for. Today's programme was produced by the series producer Anne Farrell, researched by Elizabeth O'Neill and Susan O'Loughlin, broadcasting coordinator Jarlath Holland, and on sound, Kieran Cullen.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Everyone's talking about the revolution driven by Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.